Support for the Morning Show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the Morning Show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. It is not all that often that I spend precious time in the Morning Show with a work of fiction. And when I do, it's because I think very highly of the novel in question. And the novel that we are exploring in the first part of today's Morning Show might be the best novel I have ever read. It is titled A Piece of the World, and it is by Christina Baker Klein, who is very, very well known for her previous bestseller, Orphan Train. A Piece of the World is inspired by a very intriguing, famous painting by Andrew Wyeth called Christina's World, which is on display at the Museum of Modern Art in New York City. It's among the most famous paintings of its time. In this painting, Christina's World, we see a field that is almost completely empty, except for a rather forlorn-looking, dilapidated farmhouse in the distance. And in the foreground of the painting is the enigmatic figure of a woman. Her back is to us, and she is down on the ground. She appears to be about to crawl away from us towards the house. The painting is Christina's World, and that woman depicted in the painting was someone whom painter Andrew Wyeth actually knew and befriended. They were friends for some 20 years. And Christina Baker Klein, in her novel, imagines what the life of that woman was like, and what that friendship was like as well. Christina Olson was born in the small coastal town of Cushing, Maine. Her family had lived in that region for generations. Christina, unfortunately, was increasingly incapacitated over the years by an illness which appears to have been polio or something like it. And Christina's world became more and more restricted to that small farmhouse where she lived with her unmarried brother, Al. Quite unexpectedly, the charismatic painter Andrew Wyeth enters her life one day on the arm of one of her best friends, Betsy. Betsy and Andrew Wyeth eventually marry, and what ensues after that is a most intriguing and in many ways very, very beautiful friendship between Christina and Andrew Wyeth. I'm going to share with you my interview with the novelist, and then I will read a portion of this novel to you. The novel, by the way, is published by William Morrow. Again, it's called A Piece of the World, and the author, Christina Baker Klein. One of the most beautiful lines from your novel, I think, is towards the very, very beginning when your central character, Christina, is visited by Betsy and asking how things are going with her brother. The same is good, yes, when she says the same. And Christina says, I smile, sure, the same is good. And, of course, that's so much about her, in a sense, limited, constricted world. Talk for a moment about the care you took in trying to describe such a life and such a person in authentic terms without, in a sense, being too bleak.
Gosh, that is a perfect question, because that became my obsession as the author of this book. I wanted to do justice to the real life story of Andrew Wyeth and his relationship with Christina Olson, the subject of this painting, Christina's World. So my novel, A Piece of the World, explores that relationship. In doing so, it also delves deeply into her life, as you've just described it. I wanted the reader to understand her, to not identify with her necessarily, because I think not many people will identify with her. She lived on a remote point on the coast of Maine. She had to take care of her family. She had to drop out of school at the age of 12 to do that. Her father made her She was very smart, but he made her drop out of school so that she could help run the farm. And her life was kind of quiet and a little bit bleak, I would say. She had a degenerative illness until Andrew Wyeth came into it, and he transformed her life. She and he had a beautiful relationship, an incredible friendship, and he respected her and liked her, and they talked and talked for hours. And so this, as you, the line you just read, the same, you know, sure, the same is good. But Christina Olsen wanted more out of life, and Andrew Wyeth brought her more. And that was the joy of telling this book, telling this story.
Right. I think one thing that's quite intriguing is that here she is living a very limited, constricted life, at least geographically.
Yeah.
I mean, hardly ever straying from the farm. And you have at one point, Christina, thinking to herself, when your world is small, you learn every inch of it. And yet, in some ways, she didn't know every inch of her world until this artist, Andy Wyeth, enters her life, because he enters her world, this small little farmhouse, and notices things that she and her brother Al have not noticed. I mean, talk for a moment about the artist's eyes and what a difference that makes.
Absolutely right. And later in the book, there's a line where she says, "He makes me see things anew." You know, Andrew Wyeth comes and he focuses on things in the house, a cracked teapot and the mantelpiece with shells on it and a blue door scratched by the dog. And I look at those things through his eyes and I see them differently. By the way, I'm traveling around the country doing this big book tour, and I get really bored at reading, so I'm not reading much. I might read one page or something, but I have a slideshow. And in the slideshow, I show you a photograph of the a piece of the house or something in, you know, in Christine Olsen's world. And then I show you Andrew Wyeth's painting of it. And you can see both how similar it is and how different his representation. And that was, I looked at those photographs and then at his paintings over and over again. That was what I was trying to capture in the novel, is a sense that he brought this sensibility, this artist sensibility, to her experience that made her look at it in a different way. And I think we can all agree that perspective shapes everything. That you, if you have, depending on your perspective, you can see an event as positive or negative. And I think that for Christina, Wyeth did exactly that. He provided a portal for her to see her own world in a new way.
She, as someone who comes from hardy stock, as it's described
yeah.
at one point, and of course she lives, in a sense, the tamest of lives, but comes from this intriguing family. Just say a very brief word about her hardy stock.
So her hardy stock is part of the was part of the great joy for me of researching this book, discovering that Christina Olsen, this quiet woman on the coast of Maine, was descended from the presiding judge of the Salem witch trials. His name was John Hathorne. He was the only magistrate who did not recant. He went to his deathbed saying that he was glad that he had put 24 witches to death. And he was just a brutal man in general. He persecuted Quakers and killed Native Americans and bad guy. So his family was tainted by association, you know, with him over the decades after he died. And three of them, three young men, Hathorne men, changed the spelling of their name and fled to the coast of Maine, built three log cabins in the middle of winter, one of which eventually ended up becoming the house in the painting Christina's world. Another relative of Christina's was Nathaniel Hawthorne, who changed the spelling of his name, also left Salem, and ended up writing about people like his great uncle, who you know, had persecuted others without looking at the sin in his own life. Mm. And that's what Nathaniel Hawthorne focused on. So that, those kinds of details about Christina Olsen's real history were fascinating to me, and I focused on them and I wove them through the book as well.
Right. And of course, she is someone who has demonstrated great courage in the face of her own physical debilitation and just contending with all the frustrations of life. You also tell us that in many respects, Christina and this talented painter, Andrew Wyeth, are both misfits, and that might be a key to why there is such a powerful connection between them.
Yeah, absolutely. They were both misfits, and yet on the surface, Andrew Wyeth seemed so perfect. He was, by all accounts, movie star handsome. He was raised in a wealthy family. He grew up in a mansion. You know, they had multiple cars. His father was a famous artist. Andrew Wyeth became a famous artist at a very, very young age. By the age of 20, he'd been featured on the cover of a famous art magazine and had won awards. So they seem really different. But in fact, he identified with Christina. He considered himself, as you said, a misfit, sort of an oddball. He walked with a limp because he'd had a childhood disease as well. He, you know, had discomfort in the same, physical discomfort in the same way that Christina Olsen did. She had a degenerative disease. But he also related to her because he was an introvert and because he liked to be alone and because he was stubborn and, as he said, pig-headed. And so he spent hours and hours talking with her, and they had developed quite a bond.
Well, that is just one source of great beauty in your moving, poignant novel called A Piece of the World, published by William Morrow. Christina Baker Klein, congratulations on a masterpiece.
Thank you so much for that, and thank you for having me.
And now I want to share with you a brief excerpt from the novel, A Piece of the World, beginning with the brief prologue in which we hear the voice of Christina Olsen herself talking about the famous painting in which she is depicted. Later he told me he'd been afraid to show me the painting. He thought I wouldn't like the way he portrayed me, dragging myself across the field, fingers clutching dirt, my legs twisted behind, the arid moonscape of wheatgrass and timothy, that dilapidated house in the distance, looming up like a secret that won't stay hidden. Faraway windows, opaque and unreadable. Ruts in the spiky grass made by an invisible vehicle, leading nowhere. Dishwater sky. People think the painting is a portrait, but it isn't, not really. He wasn't even in the field. He conjured it from a room in the house, an entirely different angle. He removed rocks and trees and outbuildings. The scale of the barn is wrong. And I am not that frail young thing, but a middle-aged spinster. It's not my body, really, and maybe not even my head. He did get one thing right. Sometimes a sanctuary, sometimes a prison, that house on the hill has always been my home. I've spent my life yearning toward it, wanting to escape it, paralyzed by its hold on me. There are many ways to be crippled, I've learned over the years, many forms of paralysis. My ancestors fled to Spain from Salem, but like anyone who tries to run away from the past, they brought it with them. Something inexorable seeds itself in the place of your origin. You can never escape the bonds of family history, no matter how far you travel. And the skeleton of a house can carry in its bones the marrow of all that came before. "Who are you, Christina Olsen?" he asked me once. Nobody had ever asked me that. I had to think about it for a while. "If you really want to know me," I said, "we'll have to start with the witches, and then the drowned boys, the shells from distant lands, a whole room full of them, the Swedish sailor marooned in ice. I'll need to tell you about the false smiles of the Harvard man and the hand-wringing of those brilliant Boston doctors and the wheelchair in the sea. And eventually, though neither of us knew it yet, we'd end up here, in this place, within and without the world of the painting." That's the prologue to the novel, A Piece of the World. And by the way, Christina, in that prologue, is making reference to some of the very intriguing stories from her family's history, stories based on the historical record, and stories which are explored in this novel. But now let me share with you a little bit of the first chapter from the first portion of the book, which is titled The Stranger at the Door. This is set in 1939, which is the year that Christina and Andrew Wyeth first met. And this is in the voice of Christina herself. "I'm working on a quilt patch in the kitchen on a brilliant July afternoon, small squares of fabric and a pincushion and scissors on the table beside me, when I hear the hum of a car engine. Looking out the window toward the cove, I see a station wagon turn into the field about 100 yards away. The engine cuts off and the passenger door swings open, and Betsy James gets out laughing and exclaiming. I haven't seen her since last summer. She's wearing a white halter top and denim shorts, a red bandana tied around her neck. As I watch her coming toward the house, I am struck by how different she looks. Her sweet round face is thinned and lengthened. Her chestnut hair is long and thick around her shoulders, her eyes dark and shining, a red slash of lipstick. I think of her at 9 years old when she first came to visit, her small nimble fingers braiding my hair as she sat behind me on the stoop. And here she is, 17, and suddenly a woman. "Hey there, Christina," she says at the screen door, out of breath. "It's been such a long time." "Come in," I say from my chair. "You won't mind if I don't get up?" "Of course not." When she steps inside, the room smells of roses. When did Betsy start wearing perfume? She sweeps over to my chair and hugs my shoulders. "We arrived a few days ago. I surely am happy to be back." "You surely look it." She smiles, spots of color on her cheeks. "How are you and Al?" "Oh, you know, fine, the same." "The same is good, yes?" I smile. "Sure, the same is good." "What are you making here?" "Just a little thing, a baby quilt. Laura's pregnant again." "Such a generous auntie." She reaches down and picks up a quilt square, a piece of calico, pink flowers with green leaves on a brown background. "I recognize this fabric." I tore up an old dress. "I remember it. Small white buttons and a full skirt, right?" I think of my mother bringing home the butterick pattern and the iridescent buttons and the calico. I think of Walton seeing me in the dress for the first time. "I am awed by you." That was a long time ago. "Well, it's nice that old dress is getting a new life." Gently, she places the square back on the table and sifts through the others. White muslin, navy cotton, chambray faintly marked with ink. "All these bits and pieces, you're making a family heirloom." "I don't know about that," I say. "It's just a pile of scraps." "One man's trash," she laughs and glances out the window. "I completely forgot. I came up here for a cup of water, if you don't mind." "Sit down. I'll get you a glass." "Oh, it's not for me." She points at the station wagon in the field. "My friend wants to paint a picture of your house, but he needs water to do it." I squint at the car. A boy is sitting on the roof, looking at the sky. He's got a large white pad of paper in one hand and what looks like a pencil in the other. "He's N.C. Wyeth's son," Betsy says in a stage whisper, as if someone might hear. "Who?" "You know, N.C. Wyeth, the famous illustrator. Treasure Island?" "Ah, Treasure Island. Al loved that book. I think we still have it somewhere." "I think every boy in America has it somewhere. Well, his son's an artist, too. I just met him today." "You met him today and you're riding around in a car with him?" "Yes, he seems trustworthy." "Your parents don't mind?" "They don't know." She smiles sheepishly. "He showed up at the house this morning looking for my father, but my parents had gone off for a sail. I answered the door, and here we are." "That's happened sometimes," I say. "Where's he from?" "Pennsylvania. His family has a summer place up here in Port Clyde." "You seem to know an awful lot about him," I say, arching an eyebrow. She arches an eyebrow back. "I plan to learn more." Betsy leaves with her cup of water and makes her way back to the station wagon. By the way she's walking, shoulders back and chin forward, I can tell she knows he's watching her, and she likes it. She hands the boy the cup and climbs onto the roof next to him. "Who is that?" My brother Al is at the back door, wiping his hand on a rag. I can never tell when he's coming. He's as quiet as a fox. "Betsy, and a boy. He's painting a picture of the house," she said. "Why would he want to do that?" I shrug. "People are funny." "Sure are." Al settles into his rocker, pulling out his pipe and tobacco. He starts tamping and lighting, both of us spying on Betsy and the boy out the window and trying to act like we aren't. After a while, The boy climbs down and sets his pad of paper on the hood of the car. He offers his hand to Betsy, who slides down into his embrace. Even from this distance, I can feel the heat between them. They stand there talking for a minute, and then Betsy tugs on his hand, pulling him toward, "Oh, Lord, she's bringing him up to the house." I feel a momentary panic. The floor is dusty, my dress soiled, my hair unkempt. Al's overalls are splashed with mud. It's been a long time since I've worried about being seen through the eyes of a stranger. As they walk toward the house, though, I see the boy gazing at Betsy and realize I don't need to worry. She is all he sees. He's at the screen now on the threshold. Lanky, smiling, quivering with energy, he fills the entire doorway. "What a marvelous house," he murmurs as he opens the screen, craning his neck to look up and around the room. "The light in here is extraordinary." "Christina, Alvaro, this is Andrew," Betsy says, coming in behind him. He inclines his head. "Hope you don't mind my crashing in uninvited. Betsy swore it was okay." "We don't stand on ceremony," my brother says. "I'm Al. People after my own heart, and call me Andy, please." "Well, I'm Christina," I say. "I call her Christy, but no one else does," Al adds. "Christina, then," Andy says, settling his gaze on me. I detect no judgment in it, only a kind of anthropological curiosity. Still, his keen attention makes me blush. Turning to Al, I say quickly, "Remember that book, Treasure Island? His father did the paintings for it," Betsy said. "Did he now?" Al's face lights up. "You can't forget those pictures. I probably read that book a dozen times. Might be the only book I've ever actually finished, now that I think about it. I wanted to be a pirate." Andy breaks into a grin. His teeth are large and white like a movie star's. "So did I. Still do, in fact." Betsy's holding the oversized drawing pad. As proud as a new mother, she brings it over to show me. "Look what Andy did, Christina, in that short amount of time." The paper is still damp. In bold strokes, Andy reduced the house to a white box with two gables facing the sea. The fields are green and yellow with bristly blades of grass poking up here and there. Near black firs, the purple swipe of mountains, watery clouds. Though the watercolor has been done quickly, there's movement in the brush strokes as if the wind is blowing through. It's clear this boy knows what he's doing. The windows are mere suggestions, but you have the peculiar sense that you can see inside. The house seems rooted in the earth. "It's just a sketch," Andy says, coming up beside me. "I'll keep working at it." "Looks like a nice place to live," I say. The house is snug and cozy, a fairy tale version of the one Al and I actually live in. The only hint of its decay in smudges of blue and brown. Andy laughs. "You tell me." Running two fingers over the paper, he says, such stark lines. "There's something about this place. You've lived here a long time?" I nod. "I sense that it's a place filled with stories. I'll bet I could paint it for 100 years and never get tired of it." "Oh, you'd get tired of it," Al says. We all laugh. Andy claps his hands together. "Hey, guess what? Today is my birthday." "Is it really?" Betsy asks. "You didn't tell me." He puts his arm around her and tugs her toward him. "Didn't I? I feel like you know everything about me already." "Not yet," she says. "What's your age?" I ask him. 22. 22? Betsy's only 17. "A mature 17, Betsy blurts, color rising to her cheeks. Andy seems amused. "Well, I've never cared much about age or maturity." "How are you going to celebrate?" I ask. He raises an eyebrow at Betsy. "I'd say I'm celebrating right now." Betsy doesn't show up again until several weeks later, when she bursts into the kitchen and practically dances across the floor. "Christina, we are engaged," she says, breathlessly clasping my hand. "Engaged?" She nods. "Can you believe it?" "You're so young," I start to say. "It's too quick. You hardly know each other." Then I think of my own life. All the years, all the waiting that led to nothing. I saw how the two of them were together, the spark between them. "I feel like you know everything about me already." "Of course I can," I say. 10 months later, a postcard arrives. Betsy and Andy are married. When they return to Maine for the summer, I hand Betsy a wedding gift. Two pillowcases I made and embroidered with flowers. It took me 4 days to make the French knots for the daisies and the tiny buttonhole-stitched leaves. My hands, stiff and gnarled, don't work the way they used to. Betsy looks closely at the embroidery and holds the pillowcases to her chest. I will treasure these. They're perfect. I give her a smile. They're not perfect. The lines are uneven, the flower petals spiky and overlarge. The cotton is marked faintly with the residue of ripped stitches. Betsy has always been kind. She shows me photographs from their upstate New York wedding ceremony. Andy in a tuxedo, Betsy in white with gardenias in her hair, both beaming with joy. After their 5-day honeymoon, she tells me, she'd assumed they would drive to Canada for the wedding of a close friend, but Andy said he had to get back to work. He told me before we were married that this was how it would be, she says, but I didn't quite believe it until that moment. So did you go by yourself? She shakes her head. I stayed with him. This is what I signed up for. The work is everything. That's a portion of the first section of Christina Baker Klein's wonderful novel called A Piece of the World. I'm Gregory Berg, and this is The Morning Show. The time is 8:37, and you're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Out of the archives now for an interview from 10 years ago with food writer Michael Pollan, an excerpt from an interview in which we talk about what is perhaps his most famous book, The Omnivore's Dilemma, A Natural History in 4 Meals, published by Penguin, in which Michael Pollan questions the moral and ecological consequences of the choices that we make about the food that we eat. Here's an excerpt.
You know, for thousands of years, humans have figured out what to eat without a lot of expert help. And suddenly we find ourselves in this position where we're listening to journalists and to nutritionists and to doctors to decide what really is a kind of fundamental creaturely question. What should we have for dinner? And one of the things I set out to answer in Omnivore's Dilemma is why did it get so complicated? And part of the reason, and it occurred to me too at a certain point, that a book that tried to figure out where our food comes from is not a book that you could have written 100 years ago, because everybody knew where their food came from. You wouldn't pay to read a book to find out something as ordinary. It'd right. be like buying a book on how to breathe.
Well, you even if the book were free, you wouldn't bother
you wouldn't
read it.
The time. But of course, now we don't know where our food comes from. Children, you know, have no idea. I tell a story about being online at McDonald's, and there's a girl asking about where do hamburgers come from, and her dad says they come from cows, and she says, "Oh, like milk." And, well, it's not exactly like milk.
I want to ask especially about a moment in the introduction when you talk about the lack of a steadying culture of food leaves us especially vulnerable to the blandishments of the food scientists and the marketer, for whom the omnivore's dilemma is not so much a dilemma as an opportunity. What exactly do you mean there by the lack of a steadying culture of food here in the United States?
Well, for most of history, and you still find this if you go to other countries with a really vibrant food culture, I'm thinking of countries like Italy or France, the decision about what to eat is really determined by your cultural environment. And culture is really just a fancy word for your mother. I mean, you know, when it comes to food, basically mothers for most of history have determined what you're going to eat, how much of it you're going to eat, what you're going to eat it with, who you're going to eat it with. And that, you know, you didn't have to make a whole lot of decisions. People, the force of tradition and habit basically determined the dinner menu. And if you look at our culture, though, things have changed a lot. Odds are that you do not eat the same food that your mother ate as a child. And she may not even eat the same food she ate as a child, where there's this incredible amount of churn going on in the American diet. And that is partly because historically we've never had a really strong culture of food, because we're an immigrant nation made up of lots of different cultures, none of which kind of dominated. I mean, I suppose English more than any, but that's not too great when it comes to food. So as a result, we are really vulnerable to outside influences, whether that is, and usually that takes the form of food marketers, companies coming along and selling us on new foods. That, you know, you should eat fast food, or you should eat, you know, gourmet food, or whatever is on sale at the supermarket. And so we change the way we eat more than most people do. Historically, you know, a food, what a culture eats is one of the hardest things to shake about it. And if you go to an immigrant's home, the last place to look for signs of assimilation are the refrigerator and the pantry.
That's where people hold on to their roots the most intently and determinedly.
But we're losing that. We're really losing those roots. And that's really unfortunate, because culture has a lot of wisdom when it comes to food. What people have eaten for a long time tends to be healthy, because people wouldn't remain, you know, healthy eating that, and they would stop eating it. And most traditional cuisines, you know, whatever the one it is, whether it's Asian or European or African, tend to be good ways to eat, and far better ways to eat than the Western diet that most of us have adopted, which is a very novel diet, and we're learning is making people very sick.
We're speaking with Michael Pollan, and we're talking about his fascinating new book called The Omnivore's Dilemma, A Natural History of Four Meals. I do want to get into the balance of the book, but one other thing in the introduction I just think has to be talked about, because this is the kind of thing that we so take for granted. You talk about the ways in which human beings are different from most of nature's other eaters. You say markedly so, in the way that we modify the food chains we depend on by means of such revolutionary technologies as cooking with fire, hunting with tools, farming, and preserving food. I mean, it's just so funny to think of those things as revolutionary technologies, because they've been with us for so long that we've forgotten all about the way in which they reshaped the whole act of eating.
Tremendously. I mean, we've had several revolutions in eating, and you're right to say that cooking was one of the first, and that was a huge deal, because it gave us a tremendous edge over other creatures. We could eat things they couldn't eat because we knew how to cook them. Something like various tubers that are poisonous if they're raw, when we learned we could cook them, things like potatoes, suddenly we had this, you know, vast store of new nutritional stuff, and that allowed us to grow. And cooking also makes food much more digestible. And there are anthropologists who believe that the growth of the human brain really begins when we can cook and unlock that storehouse of protein, fat, and carbohydrate. And then you have the invention of agriculture, too, where we moved from being hunter-gatherers and settled down and started growing food, and that had a tremendous effect. Not all good, by the way. It was really bad for our health. In a way, it was sort of like the coming of fast food more recently, that this whole new diet made people sick for a long time, partly because we were keeping animals. We started picking up diseases from them, but also because we weren't that good at farming, and we would run out of food and have these famines, or we'd eat too much of one thing, like all potatoes or all wheat, and suffer nutritional deficiencies. We were actually much healthier as hunter-gatherers. And so there was this initial period. In fact, we're just regaining our stature, our physical stature we had before the birth of agriculture. We sort of shrunk and got weaker with the birth of agriculture, and now we're coming back to where we were as hunter-gatherers in terms of our physical stature. And now we're having another revolution right now, and I think that is a big part of the problem that you're seeing, is that we've changed our diet more in the last 100 years than we have in the previous 1,000 since the birth of agriculture. And one of the ways we've done this is doing things like refining grain into white flour, making sugar, pure sugar, and making that common and available. these kind of transformations have had a profound effect on our biology, and they're the reason that we're getting fat and suffering from diseases such as diabetes and heart disease, diseases that really are not common in people eating a more traditional diet.
Hmm. What's kind of odd, it seems to me a kind of a strange dichotomy in the situation, is that on the other, on the one hand, you have a lot of us, I'm one of them, that spend a little too much time in drive-thrus and eating fast food on the run, this and that. In fact, you quote a statistic in your book someplace about how many American meals are eaten in one's car. Eaten in one's car.
20% of it's incredible. Our eating takes place in the car right now.
So there are a whole lot of us that are rather careless about what we eat, and we gravitate towards all these things that are not particularly good for us. But on the other hand, you also open up your book with you know, sort of expressing frustration at sort of the kind of irrational ways in which some people are trying to be very careful about what they eat, but to the point of absurdity where people stop eating bread or stop eating other central staples in our diet. I mean, does that strike you as well as kind of a strange, two-sided situation?
It's part of our dysfunction as eaters. I mean, in the same way that we don't have this steadying food culture, it leaves us vulnerable to these food fads. And we do, you know, we all say we want to eat healthily, and we're great consumers of health information about food. And so when...
Well, some people do. I mean, some people don't care much about that at all.
Well, that's true. There are people who just go ahead and eat whatever they want to eat. But there is a large population in America that when a new study comes out saying, you know, we should be more worried about carbohydrates than fat, suddenly you've got millions of Americans shopping in a whole new way, and the supermarket has to completely revise what they're selling, and suddenly you've got low-carb beer and low-carb everything, and they're reformulating the pasta and the bread, and donut businesses go out of business, and bakeries go out of business. So, you know, the food industry is at the mercy of these food fads, and they come and go, and there's always that new diet. And right now, you know, the carbohydrate is being demonized, and fat is being rehabilitated. And, yeah, there are people who aren't paying attention to that, but there are a whole lot of people who are. And it really does get kind of crazy. I talk in the book about what I call the American paradox, that you've got a population that worries more about health and food than just about anyone on the earth, but is one of the least healthy eaters on the earth.
Yeah, there it is, and the word paradox is a great term. I'm reminded of the chef Julia Child, who would say that, I mean, she was tremendously healthy and lived a long, long life, and she just enjoyed a bountiful array of different kinds of food, and as far as she was concerned, that's the only way to eat, and the only way to eat healthfully.
Well, you know, you can eat a lot of food, and you can eat a lot of different things, but she was eating real food, you know. She was eating food made from raw ingredients, stuff, you know, products of nature, not industry. And my guess is she was not eating a whole lot of fast food. I probably would have, you know, not satisfied her palate. But, you know, you look at the French. I mean, that's the classic example. I mean, these are people who really enjoy their victuals and eat lots of saturated fat and drink lots of red wine. And guess what? They're healthier than we are. What they're not doing is snacking all day long. They don't eat huge portions. They eat at these leisurely communal meals where people tend not to gorge and eat more slowly. Eating slowly is very, very important. Because it takes your gut about 20 minutes to tell your brain you're full. So if you're eating fast, you're not giving your body a chance to tell you when to stop. So, you know, we've got a lot to learn from other food cultures, and it's not about depriving yourself. It's about eating in a way that can be pleasurable and healthy. I mean, these are not contradictory. The problem comes up when you're eating, you know, things I don't even call food. I call them food products, you know, things that are the product of food science rather than industry. And I'm talking about processed foods. I think that's really where we get into trouble.
Michael Pollan, an interview from 10 years ago, talking about his book, The Omnivore's Dilemma. It's 10 minutes before 9 o'clock. You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD. previous occasion, I had the pleasure of speaking with Raghavan Iyer about one of his previous books. He is a master chef and author of several different cookbooks, including 660 Curries. And he has written for such publications as Cooking Light, Eating Well, Weight Watchers magazine. He happens to be an addict. His addiction is potatoes. And that is the subject of his latest book, published by Workman, called Smashed, Mashed, Boiled, and Baked, and Fried Too, A Celebration of Potatoes in 75 Irresistible Recipes. Raghavan Iyer, we welcome you back to The Morning Show.
Oh, thanks for having me back, Greg. And this is one of those times when I can say I'm proud to be an addict.
Exactly. Before we talk about kind of the genesis of the book specifically, I want you to talk about just how long potatoes have been such a central part of your life and a source of such passion. It sounds like they were served extensively in your home growing up in Mumbai.
Yes, very much so. I would say ever since I was a child, you know, my earliest memories have always been about potatoes. And, you know, also being the youngest child, my mother would always, you know, would get preferential treatment. And she would always say, what do I want for, you know, a meal, whether it's breakfast, lunch, or dinner? And I would always say potato. And I think after a while, she just stopped asking. It's like, why bother? It's going to be the same answer. So it's something that has always stuck with me over the years. And so I think when the opportunity came to do a book on potatoes, you know, it was a dream come true. So that was, it's a passion that is 55 years old for sure.
Tell our listeners about the meal you enjoyed at a Turkish restaurant, I think maybe with a friend, which was really kind of the direct impetus for this book being written.
Yes, this was actually my friend and my editor, Suzanne Rafer, with Workman Publishing. We had, this is my third book with Suzanne, sixth in totality, but I remember she had taken me to a Turkish restaurant for dinner, and she had ordered potatoes, which came as a side dish. And I said, gee, Suzanne, how about a book on potatoes? And she goes, sold. It was a quick conversation, and and that was it. And then the next morning, I got a call from my agent, and then I put together a two-page proposal for the book, and they went back and forth, and I got a contract to do a book on potatoes. But that is, you know, one of the things that to me was so important is the international nature of potatoes. You know, there's a reason why, Greg, this is the fourth largest crop in the world, because it is so versatile, it is so pervasive, and it is extremely accessible even to the common person. It's a cheap vegetable. It's also nutritionally solid. So from a standpoint of being able to, you know, have been embraced by the entire world, I felt I needed to do justice to a vegetable like that.
You give us a historical overview of the potato, and one thing I would love for you to explain to our listeners is, although we can trace the potato way, way back to the Andean culture, you tell us it's really not until the Incas that the potato, in a sense, take center stage. I think in your words, its full potential is unleashed or something. What did the Incas figure out about the potato?
They figured out how to actually cultivate it in ways that were much more conducive to larger crops and the different varieties that go well. You know, and they were able to you know, use fairly sophisticated agricultural tools to come up with ways that they could make the potato survive these different shifts of climate, you know, within short time periods. And so I think, to me, they were masters at doing that. And then, of course, you know, from there, it just sort of blossomed into the world. And I think that's one of the reasons why to this day in South America, I think they are just there alone because of the soil conditions. They're able to cultivate over 3,000 varieties of potatoes. And so that to me is truly the epicenter of potatoes.
You tell us in the book that there are actually 5,000 or more varieties of potatoes all around the world, and yet we can categorize them fairly simply in two directions, floury and waxy. And that's something I never knew till I picked up your book, although then I sort of rewound in my mind and realized, oh, yeah, that's right. I think I see exactly what he's talking about there. Explain why it's important to have that distinction in mind when one, for instance, is shopping for potatoes.
Because I think, you know, the starch content of a potato determines what the cooking methods are ideal for those. And so when you think about the floury or the starchy potatoes, and you think about the russets and you think about, you know, the white potatoes that usually fall under that category, high in starch, low in moisture. And I think because of that, those varieties of potatoes lend themselves well for, you know, mashing and for baking and for deep frying because of the low moisture content. But on the other end of the spectrum, when you look at the other variety, the waxy potatoes, or people call them boilers, red potatoes are very common. Fingerlings fall under that category as well. These potatoes have high moisture and low starch, and so because of that, they lend themselves well for boiling. And if you want to pan fry them and you want to keep the shape intact, they're very cohesive because of that. So they, you know, they're beautiful for that. So they're not very good interchangeably. So, you know, you can't, you know, take a red potato, for instance, and fry them. You know, you're not going to get the same results as you would get with a starchy potato. So the type of potato makes a big determination of, you know, what cooking methods you can apply to those.
You also point out that, although often they get in sort of included, that in fact we have to be careful to know that a sweet potato is actually no relative to the potato at all. I had not realized that.
Yeah, the potatoes, for instance, they come from the same family as the nightshade variety of plants. You know, tomatoes, eggplant, to name some of, you know, its siblings. But the sweet potato actually come from the morning glory family. And those, you know, unlike regular potato, sweet potato leaves, for instance, are very edible. And they're incredibly sweet. And they're delicious even if you just stir fry them. If you have, you know, access to sweet potato leaves, they are very, very good in stir fries because of its inherent sweetness. But unlike those, you know, you cannot do the same with the potato greens because, first of all, you know, when the potato are harvested, especially towards the end of summer, early fall, the leaves are always dried, you know, on the ground before you yank them out. Unless you're, you know, you're working with new potatoes, which are actually harvested early spring when the leaves are still green, and that's when you yank them out and then you eat the new potatoes. But that's really the big difference between the two.
This is Raghavan Iyer, a renowned chef and the author of a really, really interesting book called Smashed, Mashed, Boiled, and Baked and Fried, A Celebration of the Potato in 75 Irresistible Recipes. Tomorrow on the morning show, I am very excited to welcome into our studios Hassan Williams. He is an alum of the Shakespeare in Prisons project of UW Parkside professor John